40th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a bi-weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers.
My guest today is Gerard Kilagian. He was born and raised in Damascus, Syria, to Armenian parents. In 1983, Gerard came to the United States and studied hotel management at Boston University. After many work-related moves, in 2000, Gerard and his wife, Annie, moved to Maine, where they raised their children in Portland. Gerard and Annie are also the co-leaders of the Armenian Cultural Association of Maine. But maybe you know Gerard better as the Innkeeper of the Year. You can find him working at the boutique Portland Harbor Hotel, the Inn at Diamond Cove, and the Diamond's Edge Restaurant and Marina. Welcome to New Mainers Speak, Gerard.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
You've been in the United States nearly 40 years, with the latter half of that in Maine. Many of the guests on this show are more recent arrivals, and I was so curious if you have any wisdom to impart to New Mainers.
What I found when I first moved here is adapting to the lifestyle of the new country was probably the most important. Learning the language, that doesn't mean you have to give up your culture at all. I never give up my culture. I never give up my background over the 30, 40 years I've been here. But I did adapt to the language. I did adapt to the culture. I understand how the culture works. And I think that makes the life a lot easier for a new person to move on with life and progress. Because if not, you really get hindered by all of the difficulty around you, understanding people and understanding how things work.
I think it would be a little scary, too, if you never learned the language, how vulnerable you would be.
Correct. Without the language, very, very difficult. Everything would be scary, and you'll have a lot of distrust in people, not understanding what their intentions are and what they're trying to tell you. Understanding, putting the full effort from the beginning, no matter how hard it is to learn those aspects, will pay tenfold down the line in terms of quality of life.
And their children. I think people don't intentionally do it, but when they don't acculturate to some degree, their children are kept in a role of taking care of their parents.
Correct, right.
And speaking of New Mainers, you were actually in the book called New Mainers that coined the very term New Mainers back in 2009, which is now used in organizations all over town, and including this show. And I'm curious about how your life may have been impacted, having been showcased in that book, what that did to you and for you.
I think at the time I was well established when I was in the book. But what it did is it really introduced me to many New Mainers that I had not met before. And many of them met after the book was made. And I come across, whether I'm City Hall events or different things that I've attended, numerous times I come across people and say, hey, I saw you in the book. And then they tell me I'm in the book. And so we exchange stories. And talk. But it was also nice to get the story out, because surprisingly, some non-immigrants actually read the book and found out things about me that they didn't know. And it was interesting for them to see that side of my life. And because I'm more of a quiet person, per se, when it comes to my personal life, I don't necessarily talk about all my experiences to everybody. And I think it was nice for some people to read some of the details.
Yeah, it's like a cheat sheet.
Right.
It's what I did. You know, we visited and I'm like, wait a minute, I think I read about you in the book. And I went back and read it. I'm like, yeah, okay. Now I got your story.
Exactly. It adds a whole new dimension to what people see in a person. You know, they see what they see and then they read a little bit more and add that more dimension as to what it took to get there.
Yes, it's such a great snapshot in time and really showcases the wide diversity in the Portland area and in Maine. In that book, New Mainers, you said people should look to Syria to learn how Christians lived successfully with Muslims for many years. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about what your childhood looked like in Syria within your diverse community in Damascus and what kind of daily interactions you had with neighbors and people from different backgrounds there.
So growing up in Damascus, Syria, we went to a public school And most of my friends were not Armenian. Some of them, a few of them were Christian, the rest were Muslim, were different factions of Muslim. And to tell you honestly, at the time, at a younger age, we didn't really know exactly who was what. We just knew. So for me, growing up, we had a good upbringing. My father was a general in the Syrian army up until 1960s. I was in Syria in the 70s and early 80s. And, you know, life for me was good. We really got along with everybody. And most of my friends, like I said, were Muslim. And I still have some friends in that. So really, religion wasn't a big deal for us growing up.
I was just thinking back to the book, and you said that it was a much more maybe liberal time. Far less women were covering with hijabs. I know in Baghdad in that same era, people were wearing bell bottoms and listening to Mick Jagger.
Correct.
And right. things changed, right?
Exactly. And so things over the years start changing more and more, and people's ideology and started changing, and their commitment to their religions, whichever faction it is. It came deeper and deeper through different outside influences. And so that did change over time. But when we were there, it wasn't a very prominent as it is now.
Yeah, I think you come from a long line of family members that are strategic in planning where their children can have the best life coming up. Before the genocide, your extended family left Armenia, knowing the tensions mm-hmm. were building. And then when you were living in Syria with your family, your father saw that there wasn't going to be a lot of opportunity for work for you because he didn't have land to give you. So he said, how about you go study in the United States? And it's right. Very strategic, right? To make those
it
plans.
Is. Exactly. Right. And he was born in Syria, lived all his life in Syria, he served the military. And he understood the dynamics at the time, and he foresaw that it's going to get more and more difficult for Armenian Christian to stay prosperous in Syria at a certain extent. And so he gave me the option. He said, do you want to stay here and I do study here, or do you want to study abroad and stay abroad? And I chose to go abroad because a lot of my friends were going abroad at the time. My brother also selected to go to England at the time to study and then move to the United States. He's a dentist in Boston. And so I decided to follow him and to come to the United States.
Yeah, so family in both places. Do you have any crystal ball for your own children where the most strategic place to be is?
I don't. I'm letting them decide on their own where their career takes them, where the opportunities will take them. We'd love to have them stay here, but they're not in Maine. They moved out of Maine when they finished college and they're pursuing their careers. And I leave it up to their choice. We guide them, but we let them be.
You have the unusual distinction of having been a citizen of three different countries, and you hold a cultural identity from yet a fourth country. What kinds of insights can you offer having been a citizen of three different nations? I wonder what you find the difference to be between being a citizen and culture in general.
I think citizenship is having the rights to live in a country, the land, the house, the apartment, voting rights, working rights, all these things are citizenship. You know, you're allowed legally to be in a certain area and nobody can remove you from that area. So those are important parts, but culture is very different. Culture is what we were talking about earlier, is really assimilating to a certain extent into the new culture, learning the new culture, adapting, contributing, but without having to give up your own culture, actually bring in your own culture into the fold and apply that and learn from the current culture. Makes life a lot easier. Opens up opportunities. And, you know, in a certain extent, it's entrepreneurship. Immigrants, when they move, it's kind of entrepreneurship. A good friend of mine, Dr. Noubar Afeyan, who grew up in Lebanon and also immigrated because of the war in Lebanon to Canada and then came to the US. And he's a venture capitalist in Boston. And he's an entrepreneur. He started many, many companies, including Moderna, who's working on the vaccine. And he's always said that immigrants are naturally born entrepreneurs because what is entrepreneurship? You uproot your basic ideas and things. You try something new, try a new environment. You move to a new place. All of these things are part of entrepreneurship. So they have all these basic instincts in them to move, to adapt, to learn, and to contribute, learn from the ideas and come up with new ideas. And so I think that's where culture comes in. And the more you adapt to a new culture, the easier it is for you to succeed in the new environment. So I see the citizenship is one aspect of it. Culture is really a key element to a better life.
Yeah. I don't remember much from seventh grade. It was kind of a long time ago. But I do remember I really liked social studies. And I remember learning the key elements of culture. I thought that was pretty interesting. So it's housing and clothing and food and language. And I wonder how American culture struck you when it was new to you.
It was a little shocking. I mean, I'm coming from a very conservative country and not a lot of liberties. When we were studying in high school, you basically sat in class and you took the lecture. You did not argue with the professor. You did not ask too many questions. You just took the lecture and went home. So for me, I came here to college and I went to Boston University, and it was a big shock when I'm sitting in the class and the professor's asking questions and going around asking people. I was horrified. It's like, I can't speak in class. I'm not going to say anything. What do you mean? Why ask my opinion? That was like the first semester when you're learning and, you know, the freedoms and all the different things that we had here that it took a while to adapt to. But being young makes life a lot easier and a lot more prone to adapting. And it helped that I did have some Armenian friends in Boston as well. I made some new friends and they were Armenian. So they shared my culture and were able to learn together.
How did you find each other in Boston?
Through a mutual friend. So a friend of mine who I grew up with in Syria was going to MIT. He was getting his master's at MIT, and MIT had an Armenian club. And so he introduced me to the gentleman I just mentioned, Dr. Noumar Efeyan. We became best friends since then. And I met a lot of other Armenians. Some were going to MIT, some were going to Boston University, some were just finished. And until to this day, we're still all friends.
Wow, that's a pretty powerful club. All the Armenians at MIT.
That's right. At least that's where it started. And then from then on, we went on to all different things that we did together throughout our life in college and university in that area.
If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You are listening to New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Gerard Kilagian. He and his wife, Annie, are the president and vice president of the Armenian Cultural Association of Maine, an organization created to preserve the history and culture of the Armenian diaspora. Armenians were pouring out of Armenia in the early 1900s due to a genocide committed by the Ottomans at the time. Today, there are more Armenians living outside Armenia than inside. What kinds of offerings does your association conduct, and what does it mean to people who are second and third generation Armenian Americans to be involved with Armenian culture again?
Like you mentioned, we are more second, third generation Armenians here than first generation. And the Armenian Cultural Association used to be the Portland Armenian Club. And that started many, many years ago, back in the 40s and 50s, for the initial immigrants that came in and settled in Armenia. And they try to preserve the culture much like we're doing. So they used to have markets down in the Bayside area. And they also did Armenian dances. That was one way to bring people together with food and dance and music. And a lot of people attended that in Maine. It was well known in Portland. So when we came in 2000, we carried the torch, changed the name, and wanted to continue. So what we tried to do is offer a cultural connection to Armenians who are first, second, or third generation to stay connected to the Armenian heritage. In Maine, we're a little further away than Boston, where in Boston you have a lot of art, a lot of theater, a lot of music, and lectures, and schools. So that the Armenian community is vibrant. We feel removed from all that. And so we try to bring some of that to Maine via picnics that we've done periodically over the summer that attracted 200 to 300 people. We've done Armenian dances where we brought in an authentic Armenian band from Boston to bring in the music. We've created some of the favorite foods here through the community lectures, brought some authors who wrote about the Armenian experience or the genocide. And we did a few of these over the years. We've done dance groups. We've brought the Sayat Nova Dance Company out of Boston. So a lot of it is really cultural, encompassing all different facets. We try to promote Armenian culture, not just to Armenians, but we would like non-Armenians in Maine to know what Armenians are and what the culture is and where we come from.
I have to say, after looking on your website, I think I'd like to go to the Armenian cultural picnic Everyone,
it's a lot of fun.
Having a wonderful, truly love-filled time. Dancing, eating, singing, you know, having fun.
It is, absolutely. And a lot of people come and they learn the Armenian dancing. We encourage them to get up and dance, do this, the dance around with everybody else, even if they don't know anything. They walk away really remembering it. And I still see some people, and they do tell me, oh yeah, I attended one of your picnics and I attended one of your dances and I had the best time. And so that stands out with people when they get introduced to unique cultural experiences like this. And that's what makes Maine fun.
If listeners want to see these pictures too on the Armenian Cultural webpage, can you direct them to that site?
Yes, that would be armeniansofmaine.com. So www.armeniansofmaine.com.
I wonder if your experience adapting to so many cultures and speaking Arabic and Armenian, French, and English is what made you so well suited to being a hotel general manager. You won the Innkeeper of the Year award last year, which is so exciting. And I would love to learn more about your passion for what you call non-branded hotels.
So what made me a success in hotel management partly is my personality. I'm a people pleaser personality. So I'd like to take care of people and make sure that I can take care of their needs. My mom always told me growing up, you know, you'd be good in hotels. You'll do well in hotels, even though hotel management was not a thing in the Middle East. Growing up, it was not a thing. But we knew one or two people that had studied hotel management abroad. And my mom told me that multiple times. So when the time came and I came to the U.S. and applied to schools, I wasn't big into sciences. I didn't want to do generic business. So, of course, mom's saying always in the back of your head, and it comes to the front, it's like, let me try that. And I applied and I loved it. I liked the courses. I liked it was hands-on and a lot of people management. So I think part of it is that, but certainly the languages and the culture does help, because in my business, you're dealing with a lot of international employees, whether they're new citizen, new immigrants, or even just people coming on a work visa from Eastern Europe or Jamaica or Philippine or all those. So for me, it's easy to understand their fears. It's easy for me to understand what they need to know and how they need to succeed. So whenever I have interactions with them, it's not very difficult for me to be able to communicate in a way where it would put them at ease and make them comfortable working for the organization. So I think the combination of two, what made the success easier in hotel management, because at the end of the day, people ask me, you know, what is my job? Well, my job is manage people. Yes, I manage a hotel, we have rooms and we have a restaurant, but my primary job is I manage people coming, people going, and people staying, people working. All of that is people management.
And you have a charming feature that people can't hear on the radio, which everybody always likes. You always have just a little bit of a smile when you talk.
Yes, I do.
I'm sure you're an easy boss to approach.
Yeah, that's what they say. But yes, it's definitely getting the right people in the right place and moving in the right direction. So the important part is being able to work with people. Here I'm involved with University of Southern Maine. I'm on their advisory board, and I also do guest lectures at the university and also SMCC in their culinary arts program. And I always tell the students, you have to figure out early on in your career, are you a people person or not? Because if you're not, this is going to be tough. If you can't deal with people coming to you with their problems, complaining about their things, and or people just lashing out at you because something went wrong and you had nothing to do with it, you're not in the right business. And it's important to make sure that the staff are enjoying what they're doing, providing the tools. Otherwise, they won't reflect that and the guests will see it.
Do you do the hiring?
I do get involved in the hiring. I do have an HR manager that does the hiring, but most often than not, I do the last interview.
Is there something that when someone says or does it, you know, oh, they're going to fit in here just fine?
I think some of the red flags, if the candidate is really not conducting themselves professionally in the conversation, if their language is too slang, they're not making an effort to respectfully have eye contact with the guest, if they're shy and they're constantly looking away when I'm asking them a question, that's a red flag. Because if they're not comfortable talking to me and looking up, how are they going to treat my guest when the guest has issues and need to? But there's also other things similar to what you mentioned. When you ask about previous employments, there's a lot of people that go negative and start talking about everything that went wrong with the old the old job and how everybody was wrong and they were right and nobody cared. Versus the positive people, even if they had a bad experience and you ask them, they say, well, you know, the circumstance wasn't good, but I moved on because I found something else. And they don't harp on it. And that's a good sign for someone. It is a positive attitude to bring with them.
I wondered if you could help me understand better the difference between a branded and a non-branded hotel.
So the branded hotels is basically the brands that everybody recognizes: Marriott, Hilton, Hyatt, Westin. All of these branded hotels, all of these brands either own or operate a hotel or franchise a hotel. So if you look at some of the hotels in the market here, the Westin Hotel, it's a franchise. What's great about branded hotels is they do all the work. They've done all the work, the market research. If you're building a new one, they have all the specs. Everything is ready for you and you can go up and running with their direction. Even staff trainings and programs and uniform, all of it, it's all set and ready to go. When you say Hilton, everybody knows what you're talking about. You go around the country, say Portland Harbor Hotel, they have no idea what you're talking about, and they have no idea what to expect. The name doesn't give them any measure of quality, per se. When you're independent, you have none of that support. However, you have to think for yourself, you have to fend for yourself, you have to market for yourself, and you have to succeed for yourself. So what I enjoy about the non-brand is we really have to think for ourselves of how to stay competitive, how to attract people's attention to us. And that's what I enjoy about it is you have to think for yourself.
Yeah. So when people come out to Great Diamond Island, what do they usually say when they're leaving your hotel? What kind of experience did they have?
You know, most of the time when they first arrive, they would go just, wow, this is amazing. This is awesome. And people are just amazed. You know, a lot of people have never been on an island. There's a lot of history on that island. So I think people usually are pleasantly surprised when they arrive to the island and they see what the atmosphere and the ambiance is like. Then they get to the inn, and the inn is really very nicely done. The rooms are beautiful, very large, very high ceiling, unlike your typical hotel room. The rooms are so spacious. Most of them are suites. And it's like, wow, this is really nice. That is not what I expected to see. So from then on, it gets better as they experience walking around and experiencing the island. So most people come by and say, definitely, I got to make the stop every year. I need to unwind and just relax and come to the island. You need to relax. You need to enjoy everything that has to offer. And that has a large niche in a population that would love to do that.
Yeah, I bet. I bet it's one of the sweet delights of being in an unbranded, specialty, one-of-a-kind hotel.
Exactly, exactly. And people enjoy that. And they write reviews and they refer other people. We do get a lot of return guests on a regular basis every year. A good 25-30% of our guests are return guests.
And they're hoping you're there when they come back so they can say hi again. I bet. Right. Yeah. So Gerard, there's conflict going on in Armenia right now. And I wondered if you wanted to take a minute and speak to that. What's going on?
Yes, it's really disheartening to see what's happening. So, you know, the history goes back to before the genocide. Armenia had vast lands in that region. And the current area in dispute, the Nagorno-Karabakh area, it's called the Nagorno-Karabakh area, between Armenia and Azerbaijan, originally it belonged to Armenia. It was an Armenian land for many, many years. Following the genocide, the Armenians spread out and left Armenia. The genocide that happened on the hands of the Ottoman Turks at the time. And then it was under Soviet rule. During the Soviet rule, as we know, different lands are divided up to different fractions and different countries, and the countries were slimmed down or enlarged. So that portion of Armenia was taken away from Armenia at that time. So when the Soviet Union was unraveling in the late 1980s, early 1990s, Armenians wanted to have their land back, and the people in that land also wanted to be part of Armenia because, like I said, the majority was Armenian. So ever since, it's been a dispute with Azerbaijan. What changed is the alliance with Azerbaijan and Turkey. Turkey is fully supporting Azerbaijan and encouraging them to go after what they think it's theirs. And the unrest started about 10 years ago. And what was really disappointing that we did not see any coverage from national, local, international media for days, until we, as Armenians all around the world, start putting pressure on the different media. And all of a sudden, you mentioned to me today that you saw it yesterday. And that was the first time that you'd see it on CNN, which is really discouraging. And part of it is because the Azerbaijan and Turkey really have their PR machine well-oiled and going, and there was a lot of information coming from their side when the scrimmage started, with information that we don't feel is accurate. And, you know, today with social media, it is very difficult to figure out what is a real source and what's not. Anybody can be a news source on social media, and things get pushed to people, whether they're correct or not, and people form opinions based on the wrong information. So it's really sad to see that, but that's true with everything going on these days. But it's more disheartening really to see the Armenian people suffer casualties, and actually casualties on both sides. It's sad to see the suffering on both sides for something that could have been avoided.
What's your hope for the outcome of this dispute?
Well, the hope is to first stop the fighting, because really not going to get anybody anywhere, and be able to come to a resolution. There were some efforts made earlier on. These efforts stopped, and I think the diplomatic effort should continue so the two countries can coexist. Armenia is really working hard to prosper, to improve, to provide more jobs, better economy for their people within the country and from outside of the country. And really, there's no room for war for both countries. I think it's really unnecessary considering all the grand tensions in that area.
I think it's quite interesting what you said. I'd like to kind of double back and underscore that members of the diaspora, people whose families originated from Armenia, are now all over the world, and they're saying to world news outlets, hey, where's the news? There's news.
Right.
And you have to actually encourage the media outlets to share with the rest of the world what's going on in this corner of the world.
Right. We get very much consumed. The news media really tends to sift through and see what's going to get attention, who's going to click on what. You're fighting against what is the latest and the most popular item that people watching, listening, they're going to click on and read. And sometimes small disputes like this don't make the news.
Well, that, and Americans aren't trained in geography. And so if you don't know where Armenia is and Azerbaijan or Turkey, you might have a hard time caring. So here's the geography. Gerard, you are so passionate about your staying connected to the Armenian roots that you were born holding, and you share those so generously with people in Maine so that we might know ourselves and one another better. Thank you so much for taking this time today and being my guest on New Mainers Speak.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun, and thank you for the opportunity.
My pleasure. It's fun on this sunny day. I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that Gerard has selected for us. Can you tell us about why you chose this song, Gerard?
Well, this is a difficult choice because I listen to different music, but the one song that came to mind, Armenian, that really has a special heart, the song is called Karun, Karun, Karune. The singer is singing about this beautiful lady. Her name is Karun. And the reason it has a special place is because my mom's name is Karun. And so every time I go to Armenian dances, Armenian events, it's a popular song. Everybody plays it. And it just had a special spot because it reminds me of my family, my mom. When growing up, we would have a lot of parties at our house. My parents used to host a lot of people. One of my dad's friends played the accordion. We play music and they sing. And this was a popular song because everybody wanted to sing that to my mom. Seven.